On August 16, 2002, John Bailey and several of his teammates on the 1955 Cannon Street All-Stars from Charleston, South Carolina, maybe I should step back, are returned to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where their dreams had been shattered, and the bitter memories of that disappointment had remained with them as they had grown from 11- and 12-year-old boys to men in their late 50s. 47 years before, the Cannon Street All-Stars had come to Williamsport, and now here they were again, having come hundreds and hundreds of miles to the field where the Little League World Series was played in 1955. As Bailey, a slugging outfielder on the All-Stars who had become a successful architect, stood on the field, he became overwhelmed by the memories of that summer so long ago when his teammates had unwittingly found themselves in America's struggle for racial equality. Bailey remembered the pain in his gut as he watched the championship game from the bleachers and not quite understanding why his teammates and he were not at their position or in one of the dugouts. "It was very, very painful for some of us," said Bailey, choking up the tears. "Most of us gave up our hopes and dreams right here on this field." Leroy Major, a talented pitcher who had grown into manhood and into middle age trying to forget what had happened. Not long before Major left for Williamsport, he received a letter from a high school student in Pennsylvania who thanked him for his contributions to the civil rights movement. The letter told Major he deserved to be recognized alongside Rosa Parks and others in the story of the civil rights movement. As Major read the letter to his wife, the school teacher began crying and the tears wouldn't stop. "It was then I realized that adults stole the dreams of little boys. If the adults didn't stop us, we probably would have played, and if they had played, there's little doubt in Major's mind what would have happened. They would have won." The Cannon Street YMCA All-Stars played that summer and that spring for one of four teams in the first black little league in the state of South Carolina. They were selected for the league's All-Star team, and their coaches told them they would keep playing as long as they kept winning all the way to the Little League World Series. Instead, they became the team no one wanted to play. Their mere presence on a baseball field was enough to cause the greatest crisis in Little League baseball history. All this happened without anyone on the Cannon Street All-Stars setting foot on a baseball field, swinging a bat, or throwing a pitch. The team won the city tournament and then the state tournament by forfeit after a boycott led by the state's Little League director. The Cannon Street All-Stars should have advanced to the regional tournament in Rome, Georgia. If they had won there, they would have gone to the Little League World Series, but this did not happen. The All-Stars learned they were ineligible for the regional tournament because they had advanced there by forfeit. And Little League baseball rules said a team had to play and had to win at least one game in every qualifying tournament. Peter McGovern, executive director of Little League Baseball, admitted this was not fair, but rules were rules. McGovern invited the team to Williamsport for the World Series. The Cannon Street boys had no way of knowing as they rode a bus from Charleston to Williamsport in 1955 that they were riding into something that was ripping the country apart. What would become known as the Civil Rights Movement confronted how Americans saw themselves and each other. Change in ways that was unprecedented, unpredictable, and often violent. It would not be clear to these 11- and 12-year-old boys for years, perhaps decades, that they were part of the struggle for racial equality in the United States. Robert Morrison, president of the Cannon Street YMCA, a successful businessman and a civil rights figure in Charleston, petitioned Little League Baseball in 1953 to create a league for blacks. Morrison, who was then 70, was a founding member of the NAACP in Charleston. He had seen a lot of history, and much of it repeated in his mind, and he was powerless to stop the memories. But his tired eyes, however, saw beyond the white lines of a baseball field. To Morrison, the issue was far bigger than whether black kids should play with white kids. Morrison wanted black kids and black adults, for that matter, to have the same opportunities as whites. He intended to use the Cannon Street All-Stars to further that agenda. If youth baseball could be integrated, so could municipal parks and swimming pools and schools. If there could be equal opportunity for black kids, there could be equal opportunity for black adults, whether in education, jobs, or housing. Little League Baseball granted a charter to the Little League YMCA team in 1953, and players had their first game in 1954, or their first season in 1954. They played and practiced on a field of rocks and weeds and crabgrass at Harmon Field, several blocks from downtown Charleston, and a few miles from Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, where the Civil War began on April 12, 1861, and the Atlantic Ocean, where hundreds of thousands of slaves were brought from 1600s to the early 1800s. And Harmon Field was just a few blocks from Marion Square, where an 80-foot statue of John Calhoun, the 19th century defender of slavery and the voice of segregation, looms over downtown Charleston. A block and a half from that statue, 10 days ago, was when 9 black men and women were murdered at the AME church. To understand Charleston in 1955 or today, one needs to know its history. And no city in the United States is more closely associated with slavery than Charleston. Perhaps 40% of all the enslaved Africans who came to this country came through the Charleston Harbor. The Civil War began in Charleston. 4 years later, the war ended, slavery was abolished, but the racial equality that was promised was never realized. For most of the next century, Southern blacks lived at the courtesy or mercy of whites. In South Carolina, men like Pitchfork Ben Tillman rose to state and national prominence, proclaiming that black men must remain subordinate or be exterminated. If they did not remain subordinate, they should be lynched. Tillmanism was later perpetuated by other South Carolina politicians like Ed Cotton Smith, Jimmy Burns, L. Mendel Rivers, and Strom Thurmond, who ran for president in 1948 as a segregationist. In the years after World War II, blacks turned to the courts for racial equality. When the Supreme Court issued its decision in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, the Cannon Street All-Stars were in their first season. But all Southern politicians and Southern newspapers, including the Charleston News and Courier, rallied against the Brown decision. Most Southern cities and towns ignored it. On May 31, 1955, a year after Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court issued another ruling, which would become known as Brown 2. It said that all provisions of federal, state, or local law requiring or permitting such discrimination must yield to this principle. This decision further angered Southern establishment, including newspaper editors like Thomas Waring, who was editor of the Charleston News and Courier. The newspaper published a barrage of editorials, columns, and letters to the editor saying that Southern tradition and God Almighty had called for blacks and whites to be separate, and how could 9 justices on the Supreme Court rule otherwise? By May 1955, Cannon Street had begun its second season in Little League Baseball. The boys who were 11 a year ago were now 12. They were bigger, they were stronger, and they played better. And when Bob Morrison saw them, once a star athlete himself, he watched them play. He liked what he saw. Things were progressing according to his plan. Morrison planned to put his Little League boys against the white Little League boys in the city tournament at the end of the season. He kept the news to himself, but he could hide his intentions, but he couldn't hide the talent of his players. Word spread throughout the city, and white adults came to Harmon Field to watch the Cannon Street All-Stars play. One of those adults was Danny Jones, director of Little League Baseball in Charleston and state director of Little League Baseball in South Carolina. Jones was revered in and around Charleston for his contributions to youth sports. After World War II, Jones became director of Parks and Recreation in North Charleston. And when he was hired in 1945, youth baseball was little more than rocks and weeds and crabgrass. But he changed that, working tirelessly to add baseball and softball fields, playgrounds, swimming pools, and community centers. He believed that every boy should have the opportunity to play baseball, but he also believed in segregation. If the Cannon Street players and coaches had stayed on Harmon Field, Little League Baseball would have gone on as it had in South Carolina. There would not have been a boycott of the Cannon Street team. The South Carolina teams would not have pulled out of Little League Baseball. Neither would the teams throughout the South. Everything would have gone on as it had. But that's not what happened. When Morrison registered his team for the city tournament, it put Morrison, the Cannon Street All-Stars, Peter McGovern, and Little League Baseball and the forces of integration on a collision course with Danny Jones, the state's newspaper editor, Strom Thurmond, and the state's political establishment and the forces of segregation. Jones led the boycott against the Cannon Street All-Stars in the city tournament. The Cannon Street boys won by forfeit and advanced to the South Carolina State Tournament. Jones, who was the state's director of Little League Baseball, petitioned Little League Baseball to have a segregated tournament. Peter McGovern said no. He said that any team that refused to play the Cannon Street All-Stars would be banned from Little League Baseball. At Jones's urging, he withdrew from the tournament. All the white teams withdrew from the tournament, making Cannon Street the state champions. Jones resigned as state director of Little Leagues and created a league in his own image, the Segregated Little Boys League. He urged the other teams in the state to join his league, and they did. Having segregated boys baseball in South Carolina, Jones sought to segregate baseball throughout the South. By the next year, the Little Boys League had 540 teams in 122 leagues. Within a few years, there would be virtually no Little League baseball left in the former Confederacy. The Little Boys League eventually changed its name to Dixie Youth Baseball. In 1962, hundreds of leagues and tens of thousands of players played in Dixie League baseball, and their uniforms had the insignia of the Confederate flag. Dixie Youth Baseball remained segregated until 1966, a year after Danny Jones's death. Jones is memorialized in and around Charleston, but the Cannon Street All-Stars are largely forgotten, or were largely forgotten until Gus Holt revived their memory in 1994. He's a former black silver shipyard worker, and he saw the Confederate flag, or he saw the insignia of the Confederate flag on his son Lawrence's uniform and didn't like it. He led a delegation to City Hall and demanding that the Confederate insignia be removed from the Little League uniforms or from the Dixie League boys uniforms. And he revived the Cannon Street All-Stars. He became the team's historian and publicist, telling the story of the Cannon Street All-Stars to anyone who would listen. When Holt is asked about Danny Jones, he hesitates and then answers, "It's easy to demonize Danny Jones, but doing so does an injustice to both Jones and the story of the Cannon Street All-Stars." He calls Jones a pawn in the state's political establishment, which included the state's most powerful politician, Strom Thurmond, the one-time governor and now U.S. a senator. That opinion is supported by Jack Bass, who's Strom Thurmond's biographer. Bass said that Danny Jones got it on higher authority to prohibit Cannon Street from playing. Bass says that Jones probably heard indirectly from Thurmond, "We can't do anything to break the color line. If youth baseball could be integrated," Strom Thurmond thought, "so could municipal parks and swimming pools and schools. If there could be equal opportunities for black kids," Thurmond thought, "there could be equal opportunities for black adults, whether in education, jobs, or in housing." Having won the state tournament, the Cannon Street YMCA team qualified for the regional tournament in Rome, Georgia. But they did not go, because the state championship was ruled invalid because it had come by forfeit. Peter McGovern refused to make an exception. And why didn't McGovern make an exception to the Cannon Street All-Stars so that they could play in Rome, Georgia? Gus Holt thinks it was because Rome was in rural Georgia. So McGovern had reasons to be concerned for something bad could happen in Rome, Georgia. According to Gus Holt, this was heavy shit for Rome, Georgia. Someone told McGovern, "If you send these black boys down here, there will be blood on your hands." The Cannon Street All-Stars were driven to Williamsport, and they got there the morning before the finals. They checked in, they went to the breakfast the next day, and then they were taken to the ballpark. They would watch the championship game. And they got there. They stayed in the same dormitory as all the players, and then they were introduced before the championship game. And there was heartfelt applause from the crowd, many of whom had read about the team in newspaper articles. After all the players and coaches were introduced, there was applause. The players remembered, and then came a voice from the bleachers. "Let them play." Someone else repeated the words. Others began chanting the words. The words got louder. "Let them play. Let them play." It gave the Cannon Street team chills. The players said they could hear those words when they returned to Williamsport in 2002. John Rivers, who played second base for the All-Stars, says he still hears those cheers 60 years later. "I remember it as if it were this morning." After the Cannon Street players and coaches were introduced, they went back to their seats. A few spectators asked for autographs. Others brought them food and drinks. They enjoyed the fleeting notoriety, but they would have traded it. They would have traded anything to be on the field and not in the bleachers. A newspaper photograph takes a picture of them. The disappointment is on their faces. How does it feel to watch someone else live out your dreams? Early the next day, the team got back on the bus and drove back to Charleston. The bus returned to Charleston on August 28th. It was the same day that Emmett Till, not much older than them, was murdered in Money, Mississippi. On December 1st, 1955, a little more than 3 months after the Cannon Street boys went to Williamsport on a bus, a 40-year-old black woman named Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. She was arrested. In response, thousands of blacks boycotted the city's buses. The Montgomery bus boycott ended a year later, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregated busing was unconstitutional. The Cannon Street All-Stars returned from Williamsport, forever changed. Most of them were so angry they quit playing baseball. They eventually grew up and moved on with their lives, just as the civil rights movement swept through the South. For all they achieved in life, and for all they didn't achieve, the Cannon Street All-Stars remembered the summer of 1955. John Rivers, who, like John Bailey, became an architect, summarized the moral of the story. "It's a tragedy to take the dreams away from youngsters. I knew it then, I knew it now. And I've seen to it that no one takes dreams away from me again." Thank you. We have a little time for questions.
If you have any questions, please come to the microphone so the audience can hear your question. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Sad as this story may be, there isn't anything too surprising about what happened to them in South Carolina and the South, since for over half a century, the whole Southern establishment was totally committed to the idea that any mingling of the races was a step towards social equality, which meant integration, which meant mongrelization, and had to be stopped. Now, I do want to argue with one thing you said, which was that the Cannon Street All-Stars probably had no idea what they were getting into in terms of the civil rights movement. I don't know them, but I strongly suspect that they did. Brown versus Board of Ed was actually five different cases that
right.
had been
consulted. And one of them was in South
and
Carolina,
one of them was
right.
in South Carolina, that's right. But to me, actually, one somewhat heroic aspect of the story, as I understand it, is that the National Little League would not accept segregation and thus forced the South
right.
to form the Dixie Leagues. And I think there's probably an interesting comparison with the Boy Scouts that I don't think ever did that because it was not necessary to form Dixie Scouts in the South, as
right.
far as I know. So I would commend the Little League authorities at least on that point.
Yeah. But going back to what you were saying, I don't think the 11 and 12-year-old boys knew. I think their parents knew. They were 11. And they were so excited. And in those days, if you were a black adult, like Emmett Till's mom, you warned your son
yeah.
to keep your mouth shut. And you grew up in the qualities that we admire of exuberance in young children, the black parents had to, for their own good, to squash them. But no, at 11 or 12, I don't think they were so excited. This was their first time out of Charleston for most of them. They made jokes the whole way up there. Kids had pajamas for the first time in their lives. They listened to that. They had cookies, eating cookies all the way up there. But yes, their parents knew. Their parents, in fact, one parent would not let his kid go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Did Peter McGovern later in life ever express any regrets about the decision that he made?
We don't know. I mean, Gus Holt would like to get hold of. He says there are no Peter McGovern papers. So I don't know. Because the story was forgotten, it was run over, and people never talked about it. So by the time people started talking about it, I suppose he was dead. But it was also at that time when Little League Baseball was being split, that the two parties behind Little League Baseball were having an infighting, and McGovern won the power struggle. I don't know if he did.
You ran through it a little bit quickly, and I was wanted a little clarification. So the city tournament, they won by forfeit because the white teams refused to play them.
All the white teams refused to play.
And then the state championship, they weren't allowed to go to the state championship?
No, they were allowed to go, but all the white teams boycotted that, too.
Right, but that's what would have happened in Rome, Georgia?
What's that?
That was what would have happened in Rome?
Well, Rome was fine, except they were looking for a way to avoid a showdown. They did not want the black kids going to Rome, Georgia, so they came up with... It did say in the rules that you had... What made this interesting is a catch-22 is they won by forfeit, but it wasn't their fault they won by forfeit.
Right.
And the Rome, Georgia people said, sorry, you had to win to get here, and you won by... You had to win on the field, and you won it by forfeit, you're ineligible.
I see. And so then that was that's what McGovern upheld, was that decision.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then the other thing, I just want to make a quick comment. I saw in the news this morning... activists in South Carolina took down the Confederate flag this morning.
Oh. They took down the flag at the State House?
They took down the flag at the State House, were immediately arrested. The flag did not fly for a couple of hours, though, but then they put it back up in time for a white rally that's about to happen. So.
Yeah, but it's not going to come down all that quickly in South Carolina because the governor can't do it by himself. It's unfortunate, yes. Herself, I'm sorry.
Were any of the teams in 1955 in Williamsport integrated teams?
Yes. In fact, Billy Hunter, who then became the players' union boss of the NBA, was on one of those teams. Yes.
Any other questions?
Oh.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Okay,
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Very nice.